Louis would introduce me to people as, this is Keith, the big one in the back that can't sing. It shattered my confidence.
Keith Duffy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Let's rewind back to the beginning.
So starting back in 93, when Boys On kicked off, it was so successful that we couldn't appreciate it. We couldn't enjoy it because we were so tired.
So after this audition, the six of you have been picked, so you now know you are the band.
Colin Farrell was in the original lineup for Boys On. A lot of people don't realise that.
You and Shane don't get as much attention from a singing perspective. Does it piss you off?
I'm not enjoying this. So I rang my dad and I said, look, Dad, I think I'm going to drop out of the band.
Do you have that fear of failing?
He goes, look, I've been asked by Louis Walsh and John Reynolds to sit down and talk to you. They're quite concerned about your performance tonight.
When did you first start to see the money in Boyzone?
Everybody thought we were millionaires and we had a pot to piss in. We weren't ungrateful. It was just very difficult to be grateful.
Hey, Matt Haycocks here with a quick interruption just to say I hope you're liking the show, but please, please like, subscribe or comment. That's how we can bring you better guests. That's how we can make the show better each week. So please, please, that's all I ever ask of you. We never charge. We never ask anything else. Just please give us a few moments of your time.
Guys, welcome to another episode of Stripping Off with Matt Haycocks, where today I have got a guest who is going to be an absolute belter. He's a singer. He's an actor, he's a philanthropist, he's an all-around great guy, he's a businessman, and he's a good friend of mine, and he's sat here at home in Dubai. Keith Duffy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. I love your studio. It's very comfortable. I'm glad I wrote that introduction out for myself there. It sounds even better when you say it.
You know, I've always wanted to do these in the house because I thought, I've seen a couple of other people do podcasts at home in Dubai. I thought, you know, the view's good, the setting's good. But as you know, it was raining like crazy last week, and I think all the podcast studios must have had so many cancellations that they're... The backlogging up, so we get to be in the comfort of our own home.
I think it's nice, man. I mean, it's more natural, and it just gives us the surroundings to be able to be relaxed and talk freely and being open. You know, it's a nice vibe.
For me, it's always about the chair. I mean, there's a studio we used to use out here a while ago, and it looks really cool in there. But the chairs, they're quite small and they're really high, and I sit on there, and I kind of can't wait to get off them. And you know, you want to be comfy, so like you say, you can just be relaxed and chat away.
Yeah, I think you have better conversation when your environment is relaxed, and you can just, you know, put your feet up, you know, take all the stress away and just chat.
Well, look, we've got so much to talk about that we could probably make three episodes out of this.
Right.
So let's rewind back to the beginning and let's talk about how it all began and where it all began.
Wow, a million years ago, back in 1993 in Dublin, in Ireland. Feels like a lifetime ago. It's funny because my son recently turned 28, which just, I can't believe I had a 28-year-old. I mean, Boyzone, okay, so starting back in 93, when Boyzone kicked off, we had nearly 7 years of great success.
93 is when Boyzone was created, or when you had your first hit?
We had our first hit in 94. We were created in 93.
And what were you doing before that? I mean, like, you know, were you a singer? Were you a performer at all?
Well, I came from quite a hard working class background. So I've always been grafting. I've always been working. I've been working from an early age. Like when I was 13, 14 years of age, I was selling potatoes in Dublin. Typical paddy.
It sounds very Irish.
Yeah, I mean, I worked selling potatoes and fruit and veg. I worked in an ice cream van in the summertime. I worked in the golf driving range, picking up the balls, which was interesting because we used to do that while the golfing range was open. So I used to play a sport in Ireland called hurling, 15 men on a team. And it's basically like Irish football, except you have weapons, right? We have these hurley sticks. And we used to wear helmets when we played that game. So my mum used to make me wear the hurling helmet while I was working in the golf driving range, picking up the golf balls in case anything hit me on the head. But to be honest, I don't think any damage would have been done. A bit of sawdust might have popped out, maybe. That's about it. I worked as a bellboy. I worked as a waiter. I worked as a barman, all before the age of 15 or 16. And then I ended up working in a department store. My dad was the manager in the store, and he got me and my brothers in there to work for summers and Christmases and weekends and holidays, whatever. But when Boyzone started, I had done a year's college of architecture. I'd finished my final exams. I worked all the way through school. And I managed to do okay in my final exams in school, and I went to college, and I wanted to be an architect. Well, I didn't, to be honest, I didn't. But I was good. I had a flair for first of all, it's called mechanical drawing between 13, 14, 15 years of age. And then when you go on to do your final exams, it's called technical drawing. And I just had a flair for it. I was quite good at it. And I enjoyed it. There was not an awful lot of things I enjoyed about school. I didn't like school at all, and I was big into my sport. I played Irish football and hurling, like I said. So school academics weren't really my thing. This was the only thing in school that I liked to do, which was drawing. So like I said, I went to college for a year, and due to start the second year in the September, but I went away on my very, very first holiday. I'd never been on an aeroplane before. I was 18 years of age.
Never left Ireland, though.
Never left Ireland. Never been on an aeroplane. And I went to Greece, a place called Hersonesus in Crete, with my buddies on holiday. And take that were huge at the time. And myself and my pals, it's quite ironic, actually, because myself and my two buddies, every time we go out in Greece, people used to tell us that we looked like Take That. You know, we always dressed like boy band members, I suppose. And it was just ironic because there was no hint of Boyzone at the time. It wasn't anything at the time. So it was just coincidental that I came back off that holiday and the auditions for Boyzone were that October. So when I came out, I had a nice tan from being in Spain, or in Greece, should I say. And I met Louis Walsh in a nightclub called The Pod. And it was the first nightclub in Ireland that wasn't a disco, you know? It wasn't like your local chart music being played by a DJ. It was proper club music that was mixed. It was very like the Ministry of Sound in London at the time. It was the first kind of nightclub that had a mixture of gay people, lesbian, straight people. It was the first environment that I was in that wasn't your typical straight, if you like, place. So, and I didn't have many friends that were gay, so I was quite nervous in that environment. And I was dancing on a speaker on the stage one night, and this guy starts kind of pulling up my trousers, and I was looking down, and he said, can I talk to you? And I was going, what? And I thought he was propositioning me to go into the toilet. I was going, no, I'm straight. I'm not like that, mate. He goes, what are you talking about? I mean, into the VIP room. And the VIP room in this nightclub was really cool because it used to attract a lot of the big kind of celebrities in Ireland at the time. U2, Bono and the lads, they'd be in there quite a lot. I remember Michael Hutchins being in there with Paulie Yates. God rest the two of them. That was a long time ago. But this guy's name was Louis Walsh. Infamous now from the X Factor on TV shows and such. But Louis brought me into the room and he asked me, could I sing? And I come from a very musical family. My dad was a great singer and great guitar player, piano player. My brother's a great guitar player. I was into percussion. I was in a marching band. I played side drum for years. And then I played the kit in a couple of rock bands in my teenage years. So I was very, you know, I come from a very musical family. But about a week previous of this, I saw the front page of an Irish newspaper. And it had the Irish Take That auditions written on it. And it was a photograph of Shane Lynch, who's in Boyzone with me, and Colin Farrell. So Colin Farrell was in the original lineup for Boyzone. Okay. A lot of people don't realize that. And I saw that these guys were starting off an Irish version of Take That, basically. And I knew Shane really well. He grew up down the street from me where I grew up, and I dated one of his sisters years ago. And we worked out together in the same gym. In fact, Shane and I were working out in the gym one day, and this young, attractive lady came into the gym one day and asked both of us if we would do some male stripping. You know, my initial reaction was no way. But then Shane said to her, like, how much should we get paid? And we hadn't got much money, I thought, in those days, you know. And I think it was 50 quid for 15 minutes, which sounded like it's way too good to be true, you know. But when you haven't got any money, that's a lot of money. So we did it. And it was only for one night only. But we went to some nightclub afterwards and we were wearing no top, but just these leather waistcoats. And we got photographed in this club afterwards. And I was working in this department store in Dublin during the day at the time. And my dad was the boss. My dad was the manager. And every afternoon he'd go in for his cup of tea and he'd read the newspaper. But I was in the newspaper and had male strippers, Keith Duffy and Shane Lynch and you know, my mother's a Bible basher, you know what I mean? She wouldn't be very happy about the fact that son was stripping. So I was shitting myself that me man and dad were going to see the clip in the newspaper. But that was, I knew Shane well, and I saw his picture in the newspaper, the Irish Take That, and I kind of thought, I'd love to do something like that. You know, if he could do it, I could do it type of thing, you know? And I'd said to Shane, look, when you're doing that, will you put a good word in for me with whoever it is that's putting that band together? But I don't think he ever did. So it was coincidental that I met Louis Walsh in this nightclub, and he brought me into the VIP room, and he asked me, could I sing? And I told him I was from a musical family. And I said to him, is this to do with the band with Shane Lynch and Colin Farrell? And he goes, yeah, do you know the lads? I said, yeah, I know both of them already. And he goes, oh, that's great. That makes for a great friendship already. So Louis really wanted me to come to the final audition, which he told me was on the following Wednesday. But we'd no mobile phones back then. So I gave my mother's home phone number. But I wasn't really staying at home much at that time. I was kind of drifting between one mate's flat and another mate's flat and stuff like that. I wasn't even going into college that much anymore. So I'd gone to Greece on holidays, came back, and I didn't want to go back to college. I didn't want to go back and do architecture. I'm left-handed, you see. So when you're doing architecture, if you're left-handed, you smudge the oils because you're going that way. Yeah. You know, if you're right-handed, you don't. So it was a difficult one for me. But nevertheless, anyway, I partied that weekend, and come Wednesday, I was in no humor of going for any audition or anything like that. So I didn't turn up, and I just thought it would disappear and go away. And my mother got word to me to say that a man had been on the phone asking why I didn't turn up. And my mother said, look, he's having one more night of auditions and he really wants you to go. At this stage, they'd gone from 600 or 700 people down to like 10. And I was going straight in at the end.
Right.
So it was down to 8 people the night I turned up. And 6 people actually joined the band that night. That was a Thursday night in October 93. And 6 of us were in the final cut. Colin Farrell didn't make the final cut. I'm sure he's disgusted, you know. He went on to have an amazing career, fair play to him. But there was 6 of us at the time in the original lineup. And Louis Walsh said to us, okay, guys, the first thing you're doing as a band, you're on the Late Late Show tomorrow night. So the Late Late Show would be the most infamous live chat show in Ireland. And it's been on for 40 or 50 years.
And so, and just to be clear then, so after this audition, the 6 of you have been picked. So you now know you are the band. I mean, there's no song, there's no recording. You've just got the 6 of you ready to go out. And your first gig, well, not gig, your first appearance is going on this Late Show, just to start showing who you are.
That's it. Louis just wanted to get the popularity out there. He wanted to get the awareness that we exist out there. And we said, well, what are we going to do on the TV? We're going on a live TV, but what are we going to do? And he goes, oh, don't worry about that. You'll figure something out, he said. So we were all talking, what are we going to wear? What are we going to do? And Shane's sister, Tara, was a choreographer. So she came out to the TV studios with us on the Friday night, and she put together like a little dance routine to a club song that was out at the time. Burn, baby, all my energy. And I went out and I was wearing white jeans, and my granny had ironed my jeans, and she'd ironed like a white vest for me to wear. Shane had given me a set of Budweiser braces that he got on some promo night in a pub somewhere. And we were in the dressing room, and I have my white vest on and my white jeans and the Budweiser braces. And Shane says to me, take off the vest, mate. Go bare-chested, he said. And I'll go bare-chested under my dungarees. So I said, okay, you sure? Yeah, no problem. So I did that. And to this day, we still get wound up.
It just sounds so 90s boy band, that, doesn't it? When you look back at all the pictures of people with the denim, with the dungarees, yeah, with the no shirts.
Oh, man. But every single country that we became successful in would always show that clip, that infamous Boyzone clip, the first clip on the show. I mean, you must have seen it yourself. I mean, everybody has seen it. It's the most embarrassing clip ever. you look at it now.
Well, I was going to say, I'm going to look at it now, but we're going to play it over this.
Yeah,
put it on the YouTube.
It's funny. We came back, I think, maybe 20 years later, and we got dressed up in the same clothes and done it again on the same show, just for some fun.
So what happened to this six fella?
There was 6 guys. So there was Ronan Keaton, Stephen Gately, God rest his soul. There was Shane Lynch, myself. Then there was a guy called Mark Walton, and there was another guy called Richard Rock. Mark Walton, it was actually his idea to put the band together. He was a friend of Shane's. And they approached Louis Walsh together with the idea. They'd gone to see New Kids on the Block in the Point Depot in Dublin. Yeah. And they kind of thought, you know, we could do that in Ireland. We could have an Irish version of that. So they went to Louis Walsh to say, look, you know, we want to put a band together and we believe you might be able to help us do it. And then Louis ran with the idea because he knew everybody in the music business. So after the first photo shoot, Louis didn't like Mark Walton in the shot. So he took him out of the band and it looked better with five. And then Richie Rock, who is the son of a very famous Irish singer, Irish folk singer, Dickie Rock. It was his son, but unfortunately, at the time, Richard probably wasn't professional enough for Louis Walsh's taste. So Richard was pushed aside. And one of the guys that never made it past the auditions was Mikey Graham.
Okay.
And Louis still had a number for him. So he kind of came down. Mikey got down to the last seven, and they only took six. So we rang Mikey up and we got Mikey in, and that was the Boyzone. That's when Boyzone was properly formed with its original members. And that's when we got our record deal. So that was it, man. Our lives all changed overnight then. You know, we went to the UK. We did a tour called the Smash Hits Roadshow, which was genius stroke to get us on that tour, because everybody on that tour was already a signed artist. There was E17, Bad Boys Inc., EYC, all these bands, PJ and Duncan, which is Ant and Deck. And we all toured together. We were the unknown artist on the road. Everybody else was well known. We'd Love Me For A Reason was the first song that we performed on that tour. And it was a tour of all the arenas all around the UK. And all of the bands used to travel on the bus together. They were great, great days. Really, like 90s pop music was a great time in music. It was a great time for music. So we were up against two other bands on the road. There was a band called Juice, and another guy called Nick Howard, I think his name was. And we were the three new acts on the tour. And every night there was a three big dump bins at the back of the venue, and you put in your favorite band. And it was a competition to win the opportunity to sing live on the Top of the Pops, the Smash Hits Poll Winners Party, which was being hosted by Will Smith in the London Arena. And it was a big, big do. A lot of big American artists were over. A lot of really big famous singers were on tape. That was performing. So it was a really big deal. So if we won, we get the opportunity to perform live on the TV show. So we won and we got to perform live on the TV show. And it just blew up after that. It blew up after that. I think Love Me For A Reason went to number two for Christmas. We didn't get the number one spot, unfortunately, on that one. We brought out Key To My Life next. We brought out, which we wrote ourselves. It was our first own written song. And then it just, like I say, went nuts. We were living on airplanes, private jets, five-star hotels. Our whole life just changed. We were sent to Germany by the record company. They just dropped Love Me For A Reason on the radio in Germany. That became a big hit. While we were promoting that in Germany, doing a radio promotional tour of Germany that was supposed to last maybe a week or 10 days, the record company were getting in contact with us to say, look, it's dropping in Belgium. Do you mind not coming home? Can you go straight to Belgium? Leave all your clothes into the hotel laundry to be washed and dried and cleaned for you. We'll cover all the bills. Blah, blah, blah. Then, look, Holland is breaking for you. Can you go to... So a trip that was supposed to be like a week to 10 days ended up running it to 6 weeks, 7 weeks, and all of Europe start breaking for us. Southeast Asia then just went absolutely nuts. Out here in the Middle East, Bahrain, everything just... And our lives just changed overnight, and it's so successful that we couldn't appreciate it. We couldn't enjoy it because we were so tired. You know, you actually got a rest when you went on tour. Because when you go on tour, you only work at nighttime. You're on stage for 2 hours every night, but the days are pretty much your own. When you're on a promotional tour, you're up at 6 o'clock in the morning to do radio, then you're doing TV, then you might be doing, and remember, there was no digital cameras back then, it was all film. So when we were doing a photo shoot, you'd have to get all the lights set up, take one photograph, and the guy would put the print under his arm to heat it up, and then they'd open it up, and if the lighting was off, we'd have to sit down and wait for the lighting guy to fix the lights, and it could take all day. And then you know, there'd be five of us in the picture, and we'd have a stylist there, and they'd want different looks for every shot. So every time you've done a couple of shots, you have to take off your clothes again to a new. And it just, the whole day just used to, there'd be no time to train or exercise in the gym. Your diet was awful because you're just grabbing food on the go. And what should have been a really, really enjoyable time in our lives, it ended up just becoming tiresome. And you know, we weren't ungrateful. It was just very difficult to be grateful because we were so tired all the time. And to the record company, we're just a sellable commodity, and we have to stay on the shelf. We have to be accessible all the time. And they don't, you know, they don't see it that we're human beings and we need a break. We need to get home to see our families. I mean, I was a very young dad. Like I said, my son recently turned 28, and, you know, boy, that was in 96. When Boyzone were at the top of their career, you know. So I wanted to go home to see my son. I wanted to go home and see the family. And it wasn't possible. We didn't have holidays for years. It was tough.
Well, so just going back to some of the beginning bits on there then. So, because obviously we covered kind of three or four years, but just to pick up on some key bits that, you know, I know would interest me and my audience. So when you talk about the fact that it was like an overnight success and you know, you kind of did your first show and it all kicked off from there. But I mean, how long a period are we talking about from that first order? So the audition happens, you the next day you go out and you start to be announced to the world, and there's five of you. When do you then start to go into the studio? You know, when do you rehearse? You know, I mean, how long did it actually take you to get a record out, to get a single out?
Okay, well, Louis Walsh was brilliant at manipulating the media. You know,
and just because obviously I know Louis from the TV shows he'd done, and I guess for anyone younger listening, he's you know, they probably don't know who Louis is. But was he a manager back then? As in he's not the record company himself, is he? He's the manager that puts you together, and then he takes you off to try and get you a record contract.
Absolutely, 100%. Louis was in the music business at the time. He was booking bands into clubs and nightclubs all around Ireland. Back in the 70s and the 80s, we had a lot of bands in Ireland, show bands. Basically, we'd a serious amount of talent in Ireland. But with the troubles that were in Ireland, like historically through the 60s and 70s, a lot of international artists wouldn't come to Ireland to perform. There was an ignorance surrounding the troubles in Ireland. The troubles in Ireland were pretty much restricted to two or three counties in the north of Ireland. There's six counties in the north of Ireland, but most of the trouble was restricted to two or three counties. But people just assumed, because Ireland is such a small country, everybody just assumed the whole country was on, you know, was in at war. But it wasn't. It was only in the north of Ireland. It was in Dublin, where I grew up. You know, Belfast is only maybe an hour and 20 minute drive. But and Belfast was a war zone really back then. But Dublin wasn't at all. But people didn't realise that. Louis used to put together show bands to go around the country, performing and gigging other people's songs, cover versions of American artists and English artists. Some of them be even better than the original artists. But you see, the original artists wouldn't come to Ireland because of the trouble. So that's what Louis did. That was historically what he did. And he was a big man for the Eurovision. So yeah, so Louis was known in the circles of the Eurovision. He had a winner with Johnny Logan twice. He had a winner with Linda Martin once. I mean, Louis won the Eurovision three or four times, or he's been part of the winning team three or four times. So he'd be well known in those circles. But he wasn't well known outside of Ireland at all. I mean, I didn't even know who he was until I met him first. But then obviously I learned who he was and what he had been up to. And then when Boyzone was coming to an end, Ronan Keating very sadly lost his mum. And that had obviously an adverse effect on him over time. And he didn't really deal with it at the time. He just wanted to get stuck into work. And that didn't work ultimately. And he kind of felt that he wanted to get off the conveyor belt for a while, which is unfortunate at the time, but such is life, because we were about to possibly break the States. We'd been made a priority act to be broken in America when Universal Records bought over PolyGram. And a lot of, you know, UK and Irish acts couldn't break the States at that time. So we were given a fantastic opportunity, but we'd already decided to take a sabbatical of about a year at the end of 99. And it was in November. We had another about 6 weeks left on our diary that we said we'd commit to before we took a break. And it was in that time that we were in LA and we got a phone call from the boss of the new venture of Universal and Polygram. And he said, guys, I got great news for you. You've been chosen to be the priority act to be broken in the States by the new record company, which would have meant we were going to be away forever. We wouldn't have seen family and friends. We wouldn't have seen anybody. But it would have been worth it for your career, for your success, financially especially. But, you know, Ronan wanted to stick to his guns. Stephen wanted to do some solo records and music and stuff like that. Myself and Shane were very happy to keep cracking on, to keep moving forward, you know. We didn't do a lot of the lead vocals back then, you know. There was restricted, really. The sound of Boyzone was Ronan Keaton and Stephen Gately. And Louis's attitude was, if it's not broken, let's not try to fix it. You know, we're successful with these vocals, so let's keep going that way. So we broke up for a year, and that year grew into 7 years. And in the interim of that, I came out, and this is going back 23 years now, because I came out of Boyzone at the end of 99. My daughter Mia was born in 2000. So I didn't know what to do. I hadn't got the confidence to be a lead singer. I hadn't got the confidence to go out singing vocally on my own, because I'd been suppressed for so many years by Louis Walsh. And Louis would introduce me to people as, this is Keith, the big one in the back that can't sing, you know. And it shattered my confidence, you know.
How does the dynamic work in the band like that? Or not so much the dynamic, but what about the politics of the fact that, you know, you guys are spoken about, you guys are presumably, what you and Shane don't get as much attention from a singing perspective, and, you know, Ronan and Steve always get the singing. I mean, did you just accept it is what it is, or does it piss you off? Does it drive a wedge between you and the other lads?
No, it didn't drive a wedge. It did piss me off, though, because my dad was a very talented singer. My dad was a great vocalist, you know, and I used to, as a kid, going to see my dad performing all the time. And for him to be so passionate about music, and for me to be in a band now, he was delighted. But then when I wasn't singing much, I kind of felt like I was letting him down. So, and I needed the credibility for myself. I needed people to see my capabilities. And if I'm not getting the opportunity to, you know, to go at the forefront, it's a waste of time. So I was going to leave the band in the early days. I rang my dad one night after we came off. Our first up-tempo song was a song called So Good. And we had just performed on Top of the Pops Saturday night, 7 o'clock, live on BBC One, down in Elstree Studios in London, Top of the Pops. So I remember watching it as a kid. You know, when we were growing up, you only had BBC One and RT One, which is the Irish station. You know, we didn't have all these platforms like Netflix and Sky TV and all this type of stuff. So 7 o'clock on a Thursday evening was a highlight of the week. You go to watch Top of the Pops. And I remember looking at the studio and you have all these people, like the audience, and they'd be so close to their hero, whoever was singing. And I used to think, oh, I'd love to go to that show. Look how close they are to the singer. So to get to go on Top of the Pops years later was amazing. In actual fact, we've just recently shot a documentary about the life of Boyzone, and I think we performed on Top of the Pops 27 times, which is amazing. But This was our first up-tempo song, so we got a choreographer in to do a dance routine. And look, I'm not going to lie, I was never much of a dancer, you know what I mean? I was a tough man on the football pitch. Dancing wasn't my forte. I had two left feet. So it always took me twice as long as the rest of the lads to learn the dance routines. And even at that, I'd get them backwards. But Louis Walsh and his partner, who was another manager of ours called John Reynolds, who's passed away since, God rest him, they both came over to see this performance on Top of the Pops. And obviously I wasn't great. And our tour manager, who became our manager later, a guy called Mark Plunkett, he Mark wasn't very tactile. He wasn't very affectionate. He was very professional. So if he ever kind of reached out to you in an affectionate manner, you'd kind of wonder what was wrong. And this particular night, he dropped us back. We were living in the Langham Hilton at the time in London. And he was dropping us back to the hotel. And he said, Duster, all the boys call me Duster. And he said, Duster, you know, can I come up to your room for a minute? I want to have a chat with you. And I thought, that sounds ominous. You know, what's going on? So we went up and we sat down in my bedroom. He goes, look, I've been asked by Louis Walsh and John Reynolds to sit down and talk to you. They're quite concerned about your performance tonight. I said, okay, the dancing, I take it. He goes, yeah. He said, look, maybe it might be an idea to go into the dance studios a little bit earlier than the rest of the lads and get a bit of one-on-one time with the choreographer and, you know, try to do it that way, you know. He said, look, he was in a band himself. He was a bass player in a rock band himself back in the day. And, you know, he had to take a bit of time out to go and get some more lessons. He was the bass player and his bandmates wanted him to top up on a skill set with his bass player. And he said, look, I did it and it was the best thing I ever did. And, you know, don't take it personally. Just it's not your strength. So go and give yourself a good opportunity. And I got really pissed off at that. I kind of thought, you know what? I'm not enjoying this. I'm not singing the songs. I'm not a great dancer. I'm not getting the opportunities I thought I would get in the band. And every job I've ever done, like we spoke about earlier, I mean, I've sold vegetables door to door at the side of the street. I've picked up golf balls. I worked in a department store. I was a barman. I was a lounge guy. I was a bellboy. Any job I ever did, I always took pride in the work that I did. I always took pride. I always did a good job. Even if it was just counting and pricing 10-inch dinner plates in a hardware department, I would do it and I'd make it look good. And I'd walk away from it going, I did that. And I would take pride in my work. I couldn't find a part of the job in the band that I could take pride in. Everybody did something better than me. Someone sang better than me. Someone danced better than me. Someone dressed better than me. Somebody spoke better than me. I'm going, I need to find something that I can do that I can take pride in. So I rang my dad and I said, look, Dad, I think I'm going to drop out of the band. And this was early enough, early days. And he said, why? He said, Keith, over 500 or 600 people auditioned for that band and you got chosen for a reason. They know what they're doing. Like, what's your problem? I said, well, look, I'm not getting a chance. I feel suppressed. I don't take pride in my work. I said, I need to do something that I'm proud of. And he said, look, he said, find whatever that is that they saw in you, find what that is and polish it, you know? And he said, and own your position in the band and, you know, try to fight your way forward. And eventually you might, you know, get to sing a song or you might, you know. So I took my dad's advice and I knuckled down and I start ringing Louis Walsh more often. And I said, look, I want to sing more. I want to do more lead vocals. And it worked because then what Louis did was Louis sent me in to work with a producer called Ray Madman Hedges. And Ray, I wrote some songs with Ray and I sang them. And then on all of our live shows then, I used to sing my own live songs.
Okay.
The rest of the boys would get a clothes change backstage, and I would go with our live band. I'd sing my songs. They're all really kind of up tempo rock songs. I, you know, my vocals would be very rock orientated. So I was happy with that. But also, he allowed me to put one of my songs on the B side of one of the boys' own singles, and the boys' own song, No Matter What, which to this day is in the Guinness Book of Records, is one of the biggest, or the biggest selling boy band song of all time. And nobody ever told us the rules and the regulations of how the music business worked on a financial basis. So we had no idea at the time that a CD or a tape that we had originally, and then it went to CD, but the B-side is 50% of the publishing royalties of the A side.
Okay.
So it's equal. So it doesn't matter if you're not a very talented songwriter. Put any type of crap on the B side and you will get 50% of the publishing royalties. Now, in Ireland at the time, back in the 90s, publishing royalties were tax exempt. And we pay a very high bracket of tax on everything else. So publishing royalties. So if you write a song, if you write a play, if you write a movie, if you write anything, it's tax free. And it was an incentive, I think, put together by the Taoiseach, which is like the Prime Minister in Ireland at the time, Charlie Haughey, and I think Bono from U2. They were trying to encourage artists to stay in Ireland or to come to Ireland. And the best way for that to happen was to give them an incentive in their taxes. And that's publishing royalties was the tax exemption. So we weren't told that. We didn't know that. We put cover versions out. A Daydream Believer by the Monkees. We recorded that song and put it on the B-side of Rummy for a reason. So we made the Monkees a lot of money, whoever wrote that song. We could have put Ba Ba Black Sheep on this and made ourselves some money, but nobody ever told us. So we put, and this is how we all found out. We put a song called Where Have You Been that I wrote on the B-side of No Matter What. No Matter What was written by Andrew Lloyd Webber, and it was for a musical called Whistle Down the Wind, and it became our biggest hit of all time at the time. And I had the B-side. And we were in Newcastle in the Malmaison Hotel in Newcastle the night before a gig, and our accountants came into the room and they gave me a check. And there was no check for anybody else in the band, there was only a check for me and a check for Andrew Lloyd Webber. And it was a considerable amount of money. And I go, what's this for? He goes, well, your royalties off the B-side of No Matter What. And I said, wow. And they said, yeah, it's 50% of the A side. So that's when everybody started writing. That's when everybody wanted to start writing the songs and getting the B-sides, because then we realized there's money to be made here, you know? So that was a nice little payday that day, I have to say. So I did get to get creative along the way from time to time. I mean, no more, definitely no more than what I'm doing now. I mean, what I'm currently doing now with Brian McFadden, you know, I've written and recorded the whole album with Brian. I'm up singing the lead vocals of every song, 50-50 with Brian. Now, Brian's a great performer. Brian's a very, very naturally talented guy. You know, he could pick up the Yellow Pages and he could sing it. You know, my vocal capability is limited compared to Brian's, or my dad's for that matter. But, you know, I've worked really hard on my vocals. I need to warm up before a show. I need to exercise and warm up before a show. Brian doesn't need to. He can just go out and sing. And my confidence levels now are much better. They're fine. You know, I can get out and do what I do. I mean, I've been performing now for 30 years, so I've got loads of confidence. Like, things would put amateurs off wouldn't even bother me. I wouldn't even realize. So how does it work? Louis Walsh was the manager. He went and he got Polygram Records in Dublin to sign us to one of their companies called Polydor. Polydor then, we had a hit in Ireland with Polydor. And then the UK sister of Polydor decided to sign us for the UK. Then our first song was released in the UK, which was Love Me For A Reason. That was a big hit in Ireland as well. And then Love Me For A Reason was the one that kind of broke us into all the other territories. So now our main record company was based in London. And then we went on touring for 6 or 7 years, going into the studio, recording the songs, going into the dance studio, learning the choreography. I mean, even if there were slow songs, we still had choreography, the five of us. I mean, Love Me For A Reason was literally a hand movement that was like, don't love me for fun, girl. Let me be that one girl. You know, yeah. So there are all the different kind of unified dance moves that we did together. And that was it until like I said, we took that year out in the end of 99 into 2000. And we just disappeared, didn't see each other for 7 years. At the end of 2007, BBC put us together to do a medley of three of our songs for Children in Need, for the big charity Children in Need show. And we got back together for about 3 or 4 days in London, and we rehearsed the medley and put a dance routine together for the three songs that were in the medley to perform on Children in Need. We had a great time in the studio. We were messers, so we always had a bit of banter, a bit of fun. And we realised that, God, this is great fun. Maybe we can go back. We're all a little bit more mature now. We've all gone off and done solo projects. I went into Coronation Street for years. I became much more known for Kieran McCarthy than Keith Duffy. So going back to the boys after doing that, we decided, what about if we get back together and we go back on the road? Would it work? Would people come? Will they buy the tickets? Who knows? So we got our promoters and our agents back on hand, and we put a tour on sale, and it sold out in like 4 minutes in 2007 into 2008. We toured 2008. The tour went into 2009, and we went into the studio and we start writing and recording a new album, which ultimately was released called Brother. And the reason for that was in October of 2009, the 10th of October 2009, unfortunately, Stephen Gately lost his life. In Mallorca, he had a pulling edema, which basically meant that he had a heart defect that was undetected, and it was hereditary. His uncle had died similar circumstances a couple of months previous. He vomited and unfortunately choked on his vomit. His lungs didn't clear out his airwaves, and he died. And that was a really, really, really difficult time.
When had you last spoken to him prior?
We'd been in the studio recording the album. We'd all been together quite a bit. And myself and Stephen, all through the years when Boys on Wear together, remained great friends. I went to see all his shows in the West End, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, where he played the kid catcher. At Christmas time, he'd always do panto, and I'd always go and see him in his panto. So I kind of maintained a great friendship with Stephen over all of the years. And then he was on holidays in Mallorca, and unfortunately, we got a call to say that he'd passed away. And we all flew straight to Mallorca, actually. And we put all the arrangements in place to get him, to bring him home. It was a very difficult time, very, very sad time. We slept actually in the church with Stephen the night before his funeral, because his mum and dad had left the family house and they'd moved into his into help, what do you call it, supported help?
Assisted
living, sorry. And they didn't have a room to lay Stephen out in the house because it would be a real tradition in Ireland to have the body laid out in the home. And we have a wake, people come in all through the night and drink and sing and pray and all this type of stuff. And they didn't have the room to do it anymore. So I had offered his mum and dad to use my home. To come out, but I live in North County Dublin and they're from the city centre, so they wanted to, and Ronan actually offered to use his home as well, but again Ronan lives outside of Dublin, so we said we'll just have to go to a funeral home and then we'll put Stephen in the church. And she goes, oh no, you can't do that, he doesn't like the dark. So I said to her, okay, well we'll stay with him, we'll sleep the night in the church with him. So the night before the funeral we all slept in the church with Stephen. And it was a very funny night because Stephen had a great sense of humor. And it was all very surreal for us. You know, you're having emotions come over you, like waves of emotions coming over you. One minute you're laughing, the next minute you're crying. But it was on the radio that we had decided to spend the night in the church. And the sacristy door where the priest's room was called the sacristy. And it was St. Lawrence O'Toole's church in Sheriff Street, which is a city centre in Dublin. And fans flew in from all over the world. They did the gardens of the church to get it ready for the funeral. They painted the railings, they cleaned the streets. It was unbelievable. The kindness and the generosity that people showed us was mind blowing. But we're all lying on the floor in front of the altar in the church. And we get a knock on the door about 8 o'clock at night. And there's a shop in Dublin city centre that sells camping stuff. It's Army Bargains, it's called. And they brought down a box of four mattresses and sleeping bags and pillows, which is really nice, you know. And then about a half an hour later, we get another knock on the sacristy door. And there's a very famous fish and chip shop in Dublin called Burdock's. It's the best fish and chips in the world. And they sent down a load of fish and chips for our tea. And then there was in the IFSC, there was a wine bar. And they sent down bottles of wine and beer for us. So it was just, it was on the radio, so people knew we were there.
And who was in the church? Just the four of us
and Steele. So about 2 o'clock in the morning, we're lying on the floor in front of the altar in our sleeping bags. And I could hear somebody going, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me. I'm going, who's that? Like, who's in the church? Now, the church was surrounded by police. We knew we were safe. But I looked up, it was Daniel O'Donnell and Magella, his wife. You know Daniel O'Donnell?
No.
Daniel O'Donnell is a very, very famous Irish singer. Your audience will all know him. He's historically famous for being a real showman. And the mammies love him. All the mammies love him. And he'd be like a hero to all of our mothers. And, you know, and he's a lovely, lovely man, a real sincere gentleman. And he heard on the radio that we were in the church and he popped down with his wife to say hello, which was really nice. And that was it. We didn't know what to do then after we lost Theo. It was never going to be the same again. So that was in 2009. We toured again in 2011, and it was too soon.
And just remind, so at the point that he passed, you were still active again because you'd just been in the studio.
We were ready to bring out a new album.
And you were ready to tour again as well?
Yeah.
So when he did pass, everything got put on hold at that point?
No, there was no tour dates in play. We were waiting on the album to be finished. So we went and finished the album.
Oh, so some of the albums got him on and some have.
Yeah. We haven't. There's a song called Gave It All Away. And it's a beautiful song. And Ronan and Stephen sang the lead vocals on it. And they all sing all of the song. And then the producer will decide which parts he's going to keep in. And it was a song that we couldn't release. There was some sort of political problem with the song and the lyrics or the music or the melody or something. But it was written by Mika.
Oh, yeah.
And it was called Gave It All Away. And it was a beautiful song. It was one of Theo's favourite songs. And we were told we weren't allowed to release it. There was some politics within the record company and Stephen was really disappointed. So when Stephen passed away, we were getting a lot of media interest and it wasn't very healthy for us. They were hanging outside our houses and all sorts of stuff. And Larry Mullen, the drummer from U2, he reached out to us and said, look, you know, do you want to come over? We're playing the States at the moment. We're in LA. Do you want to come over and see the LA show, you know, get you away from Ireland for a few days and give you some peace and quiet? So myself and Ronan and our partners flew over to LA. We stayed in the Beverly Wilshire, and the U2 lads brought us to their show in Pasadena, in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, which was amazing. And it was the first concert in the world to go out literally to millions and millions of people. It was a live stream on YouTube. It was a live stream on TV. It was 100,000 people in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, but it was going out. It was being blasted out all over every social network. It was amazing. But I was there, and Ronan and I were standing on the music desk with every celebrity you can imagine in LA. Like Colin Farrell was there, David Beckham was there, all sorts of actors and singers were all at the show. Don Johnson. I mean, I remember going into the VIP pre-show drinks tent, and everybody in the room, you'd know, you know, every single actor and singer you can imagine was there. It was an amazing experience. But anyway, we were staying in the Beverly Wilshire, and we're getting out of the lift one day, and as we're getting out of the lift, Mika is standing there. And we'd just been trying to get this song off the ground, but we couldn't release it. And the reason we did want to get it off the ground, because it was Theo's favorite song. And the opening line of the song was, "I've learned to live before I die," which is just bizarre because he passed away then. And we told Mika the story. And the next day, a guy called Lucien Grange, who's has been all the press recently for not good reasons, but Lucien is like the big boss of the record company. And Lucy rang Ronan and said, "Look, I don't know what you did, but you've got that song. Mika's been in touch, and that song is yours to release." So we recorded a video of us writing letters to Stephen, telling him how we felt about life as it was then. And the video, we basically shot the video for the song, and Steel features in the song. And it was a dedication to his life, basically. And we released that song, and that was on the, and we called the album the Brother Album for our brother. And we toured in 2011, but it was too soon. We were messed up. Myself and Shane were messed up. We drank too much. We did too much of everything. And ultimately, by the end of the tour, we were broken. So we had to just stop and go away.
And why were you doing that? Because of the pain from Steve?
Yeah, there was two. You get used to the dynamics of five people on stage, and he was such an amazing performer. He's such a talent. Losing him was just a huge void that we didn't foresee before we went on tour without him. That was 2011. And then in 2013, we start getting phone calls off record company and management going, "Look, you boys, it's your 20th anniversary. Do you not want to get back together and do a tour for your 20th anniversary?" We'd had 2 years without seeing each other, and we decided to get back in and see how we'd feel about going back on the road again. And we did. And we brought Stephen with us this time, on stage, old footage, video footage, all sorts of stuff to make him feel really part of the show. And that helped us a huge amount. So the tour in 2013, the 20th anniversary tour, was a great time. And it was shortly after that, I ended up going into the West End then. I went back to Corrie for a while, and then I went into the West End and I did a show called A Handful of Stars in Trafalgar Studios. And that was a great experience. That was a brilliant experience. It was a tough one because when I'm performing as an actor on a straight stage, I have to be good enough that people see past Keith Duffy from Boyzone and see past Kieran McCarthy from Coronation Street and see the character that the writer has portrayed. So I have to make sure that I'm 110% professional on these gigs. And I really love that. It scares the shit out of me. That space in Trafalgar Studios, I think there's only 120 seats. It's not a big venue, but it's intense because it's in the half round and everybody's raked. The seats are raked, so you're down on the bottom and everybody's around you, eyeballs everywhere. And I think at moments in the show, I had 12-page monologues to do. And it's tough, you know. You start panicking if there's an empty carriage, they call it, which means you forget your words. You know, and if that empty carriage comes in, that empty train carriage comes in, it's like, oh my God, you have to make sure you've got the ability to improvise and get through the scene. But I loved doing that, and it was me doing that. So there was, just to tell you a funny detour story, Boyzone was getting back together to do one-off shows that summer. It was the July of 2015, I think. And the World Cup final was on, so it was a 2014 or 2015, I can't be sure, but it was a Sunday of the World Cup final. And there's a matinee show on the Sunday, and they'd moved it to the Monday to give me the Sunday off because Boyzone were performing in Hyde Park with Tom Jones and 10cc. And it was the day of the World Cup final, like I said. So there was 125,000 people there that day, and we did a 2-hour set. It was an amazing show, just an ocean of people. It was amazing, it was electrifying. And I'm coming from playing 120-seater to playing 125,000 people. And it was a great night, but the theatre's harder. The theatre's harder because it's more intense, it's more personable, it's more upfront. People can see your eyeballs. When you're in front of 125,000 people, you don't get eye contact with anybody. You're just looking at an ocean of people. But to tell you the difficulties of what you have to adjust to sometimes. So we went out after that show. We always historically would bring our crew and the people that work with us to Benihana's on the King's Road, which is a Japanese restaurant with a tapenaki. They cook the food in front of you, and it's a great bit of fun. And we would always go there, and they'd give us a lock in there till all hours in the morning, and we'd have a great party in there with the crew, and the food is fantastic and da-da-da. But the next day I had the matinee show that was moved from the Sunday to the Monday. So I turned up to the studio to do the matinee show, and I'm dying with a hangover. And the stage manager comes in to say, guys, don't get changed. The rule of the theatre is if there's more people on stage than there is in the theatre, the show is cancelled. And I said, but we're sold out. What do you mean? She goes, no. The email that was supposed to go out explaining to people that the Sunday matinee has been moved from Sunday to Monday didn't go out. So there was people queuing up on Sunday for the show that wasn't on. So nobody turned up on the Monday. There was seven people. So there was eight of us on stage. There was seven people turned up to see the show. So she said, you can go home. I was never so happy in all my life. I put back on my civvies. I was about to walk out the stage door. She goes, guys, you're not going to believe it. You have to do the fucking show. You have to do the show. Some fuckers have to come up and buy a ticket. You have to. So now there's eight people in the audience and eight people on stage. So the show must go on to eight people. 2-hour show. I thought, oh my God, a monologue. You can hear your voice echoing off the walls because the place is empty. So we went there anyway. And it's my best friend, Rico, who tour manages a boy's life. He works with Boys On. He wanted to support the arts and he support my career. So he went and bought a ticket and he sprawled across three seats at the front, tried to make the place look busy. And the thing about it is, if he had just told me, I would have just gotten a ticket and said, come tonight, don't come today, you know? Anyway, I had to do a full performance for eight people after doing 125,000 the day before. So that, you know, that's being grounded. That's being able to adjust to your situation. It was at that time that I wanted to do a one-man show. It was the only thing I hadn't done before, and I wanted to write my own show.
Singing or acting?
No, stand-up, singing. Yeah. Not singing, acting, but not even acting. Maybe just telling a story. I don't know. I wanted to write something that I could do on stage on my own because it's the ultimate loneliest place in the world, and it's terrifying, scary. And I like the fear. There's something about the fear I like, and I wanted to try and do it. So I was talking to a guy called Des Bishop, who is a stand-up comedian from America. He's Irish-American, and he's a really, really talented, very, very, very intelligent guy. And I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, like, stand-up comedy? I said, yeah, well, I want to be funny, but I want to be entertaining, and then I want to be sincere and possibly sad. And he goes, that's a life story you're talking about. So he said, why don't you do an autobiographical show? He said, think of the career that you've had, Keith. Think of the people you've worked with. Think of the stories from backstage, the parties on the nights out. He said, find different parts of your career in Boys Own, people that you've performed with, and tell the story of how you met them. How did you feel when you were performing? Were you nervous? The difference between, you know, not being famous, all of a sudden being famous, and meeting these people that are your heroes. I mean, off the top of your head, who's really, really cool that you worked with? And I started thinking, I went, well, actually, you know, I sang with Pavarotti in Modena in Italy. He sent his private jet to fly us over. He goes, that's a great story. So he said, tell that story. And what song did you sing with Pavarotti? And I said, well, we sang No Matter What. He sang it operatic and we sang it. He goes, well, then tell that story and sing that song. There's one part of your show. To get a few more stories of a few more people. And then he said, there you've got a full autobiographical show. So I went away and I wrote the show. I worked with Joe Cocker, B.B. King, Gloria Estefan, Mariah Carey, U2, the Bee Gees. There were so many different stories. I thought, geez, I have enough for two or three shows here. So it was at that time, myself and Brian had always met each other over the years. Brian's career started with Westlife. on the Boyzone tour. They were our support artists back in 98. So they went straight into an arena tour. We played the back of trucks. We played nightclubs, discos. We had no clothes. We had to buy our own clothes. We wore, and Shane's dad owns a garage. He was a mechanic, and he gave us overalls to wear on stage. Bright orange overalls we wore on stage. You know, Westlife came in, got a record deal straight away off the back of the success of Boyzone with Louis Walsh. And Ronan Keating was their manager at the time as well.
I remember reading that in the press at the time. That wasn't just a publicity gimmick.
It was a complete publicity gig from Louis' point of view. Boyzone were going to come to the end of their days quite soon. Ronan's no doubt going to have a solo career. Louis wanted to manage Ronan and keep Ronan beside him. How to do that? Well, give Ronan a part of the management of Westlife. So we were touring in Thailand in 96, 97. And I rang my dad one night and he said, enjoy yourself, son, your days are pretty much numbered. I said, how do you mean? He says, well, while you guys are touring Southeast Asia, Louis Walsh is all over the TV and the press putting together a new boy band from Sligo. I said, you're kidding me. He said, no. He says, I'm telling you, he's getting ready for your demise, so he has something ready to go when you guys decide to split up. He got Ronan to become part of the management, which obviously then, you know, encouraged Ronan to want Westlife to come on tour with us. Because bands back in those days would spend a huge amount of money to be your support act because they're getting a ready-made audience. Yeah. Westlife came on for free. They didn't have to pay on because Ronan and Louis were their management. But that's how I met Brian. Now, me and Brian were similar characters. We always got on well. When he was living in Australia and I'd be touring with Boyzone, I'd always go out on the piss with Brian and have a bit of fun, play golf with Brian. We were invited to play a lot of the same charity events and golfing together. And I'd met him on one of these charity events. We played golf and I said, how are you getting on? He just come home from Australia. He said, I'm playing Whelan's in Dublin on Saturday night. Whelan's is a very incredible rock venue. So to go from a boy band to playing Whelan's is pretty cool. And Brian was going to gig there with his full live band with all his own songs that he had written and released in Australia. So I said to him, I'll come and see your show. I was finishing up in the West End and a handful of stars that play. So I went to see Brian's show with my son Jay and myself and my son have a lot of communal friends. So we went to see Brian's show. After the gig, he was brilliant. He blew the roof off the place. After the gig, we were in the dressing room having a few pints of Guinness. And Brian said to me, what are you up to at the moment? I says, well, I've just finished writing an autobiographical show that I'm going on a tour. I've done a deal with the Hilton Hotel Group and I'm going to do the function rooms of the Hilton Hotels across the UK. And I said, I'm very excited. He goes, oh, that sounds a great idea, man. And I was telling him the stories, you know, Pavarotti and the Bee Gees and this, that, and the other. He goes, oh, wow, I'd love to do something like that, he said. And I'm kind of thinking, I wanted to do a one-man show, but at the same time, if it was in the one venue every night, like a residency, that would be fine. But the fact that we're going to be touring, it's a very lonely world on the road and you're touring on your own. So I said, look, why don't we rewrite it together and we'll change it. And the two of us will do it. That means we've got the back catalogue of all the Boyzone hits and the Westlife hits. The Boyzone fans and the Westlife fans, if they're not the same. And I said, and we'd have a great bit of fun. So he said, yeah. So we rewrote the show. We put it on sale and it sold out in 4 hours. The whole tour, 52 dates, sold out in 4 hours. 4 nights into the show, it was called Boys Life, Stories, Laughter, Music. Boys Life was never supposed to be a recording artist. Boys Life was just the name of an autobiographical show. And organically, it grew into a recording artist. And we went into the studio and wrote an album and so forth. And we've been singing and gigging ever since. But it started off like an autobiographical show. It was called Boys Life Stories Laughter Music. And 3 or 4 nights in, we'd so much material. The first show was 3.5 hours long. It was way too long. So we cut it down to 1 hour 20 to 1 hour 40 and took half the content out and realized we had another show ready to go. So we put another show on stage, Story, Laughter and Music Part 2 for the following year. And we put that on sale and that sold. Because only COVID happened, we've been nonstop for the last 7-8 years now. So it's great. And Brian's helped me enormously with my vocal ability. We sat down, we did vocal coaching, and we sat down, we wrote the shows together. We just recorded our own studio album. And as you know, we were here gigging in the Jumeirah Golf Estates on Saturday night, and it was great fun.
How does it feel doing the smaller stuff? After obviously, you know, so many years of doing the big stuff. I mean, look, we talked about it a minute ago when you had the eight-man theatre and then the 125,000 people. You know, when you've used to doing Boyzone, and I don't know how big an arena is, but you're doing 20, 30, 40,000 seats and you're doing that regular. And then now you do like the boys' life stuff, which is to a smaller audience. I mean, does that ever hurt the ego?
No, not at all, not at all. And I can understand the question. It's amazing to play the big venues. The arena tours are great. Stadiums are just, there's an old saying, stadiums are for the bands, theatres are for the fans. All right. If you're a fan of a group, you'd much rather see them in the theater than you would like to see them in a stadium.
Absolutely.
You might as well watch it on TV if you're in a stadium. And we didn't do a stadium tour. We did a couple of stadiums. We'd never done a stadium tour. Our tours were predominantly in boys only arenas. So you've got the MEN, you've got the Wembley Arena, you've got all these arenas around the cities of, there's a gorgeous one now in Glasgow. What's it called? It's a brand new, it's like, I can't remember the name of it, but I got to perform on it with Boys On in the last 25th anniversary tour that we did in 2018. I can't remember the name of it, but it's stunning. It's a wall of people. It's like a half the big circular venues. I can't remember, but it's
like
half
a Colosseum.
Circle.
Huh? Like a Colosseum.
Yeah, it's like a half a Colosseum, yeah. Right? And it's just a wall of people. There's loads of layers to it. And it just feels like they're on the stage with you, but there's millions. It's a fantastic, the Hydro in Glasgow, brilliant venue. When you're backstage, Belfast was our first gig back after 7 years away. And it's called the Odyssey in Belfast. And it holds about 18,000 people, which is a lot of people. And it's that roar, that scream of the crowd that I hadn't heard in 7 years. And we're all under the stage, ready to pop up in our trapdoors to come onto the stage after being gone for 7 years. And that energy and that roar of the crowd, just you're under that stage, man, and you're shitting yourself. You go, whoa! I mean, nerves aren't even. It's unbelievable when you haven't done it so long. And then you're catapulted onto the stage and the energy you take off the crowd, you just, honestly, you perform the best you can ever perform. They lift you, the crowd lifts you. And it's an amazing experience. And I'd be lying to you if I told you I don't miss that. Of course I do. It's an amazing feeling. But the theatres that we gig in now, myself and Brian, it's very personable. You know, we see the whites of people's eyes. They go on a journey with us. It's great to have the super success and the super fame of arenas, but there's something gorgeous about playing the theatres. As an artist, as a singer, as someone that likes to entertain people, it's much more personable and it's really, really beautiful. It's an enjoyable experience. The arenas are and always will be a phenomenal feeling. But just to be still 30 years later in a position where we're selling out theatres. And these theatres, you have to remember, are historically had the biggest superstars in the world performing in them. Backstage in these theatres, they have all the posters of the people that have performed there historically before us. And everybody who's anybody has performed in these theatres. City halls, town halls, theatres, 200, 300 years old. The history that goes with them is phenomenal. You're part of a movement when you perform in these places. And it's very special. It's very special. We have a new tour of all the theatres in the UK just launched last week for January, February, March 25 next year. So that's the next time that we're going to tour the UK. And I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really excited about it. There's also stories, our plans being made. The band Blue are back together. And there's talks, we've got the same agent. And there's talks of Blue and Boys Life coming together and doing an arena tour together with the same live band and you know, doing a joint headline type thing, you know?
Would you all be on stage together? Or they do a bit, you do a bit?
We'll do our bit, they'll do their bit, and then we'll do a bit together. So there's talks about that at the moment, and hopefully that comes to fruition because that would be great fun.
Well, as a boy band junkie, I've got my fingers crossed for you.
Well, I've got another scoop for you that you love, right? So AJ from Backstreet Boys and Joey from NSYNC have decided to do what Brian and I did, a hybrid of the two bands. And we saw it, and obviously we toured with the boys for years, so we've reached out to them, and they're very, very excited about the prospect of NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, Boys Own, and Westlife all being represented on the one stage for a tour. So that's something else that's in the pipeline at the moment, and hopefully that comes to fruition.
And I guess from a business perspective, when you do things like that, you could play bigger venues as well, can you? Because there's more audience, right?
Yeah, I mean, the bigger venues are great, but they're not important. You know, what's important is that you're doing what you love to do.
Yeah.
And like I said, as a fan of music, I'd much rather see my heroes in a theatre.
Well, I'd rather have you in the front room here now.
Yeah, yeah. I'd rather do that than go to a stadium. You know, they're great, but if you're a music lover, you'd much rather see them. Like when Adele was only breaking, and she broke very quickly. She went from theatres to fucking stadiums overnight. She honoured the gigs that were already in her diary that were smaller, the theatres that she started off in. And there's a beautiful theatre in Dublin called the Olympia. And it's stacked with history. And my buddy used to run the place. So I got to see Adele, because she's an amazing singer-songwriter. And I got to see her in the Olympia, and I got the Royal Box that night. So I was literally sitting as far away from you as I was from her that night. And she was there, and it was beautiful. And I was in that venue as well for the script. When the script really blew up, they had booked to do a gig in the Olympia, and I had the Royal Box, and I was right beside them. And there's something amazing about experiencing a band when you're up close and personal like that. And I suppose for fans of Boyzone or Westlife or Boys Life, they're getting that experience. And I know how exciting that is. So they're getting that experience. And I'm happy to give them that experience. You know what I mean? And I, like I said, I'm just happy to be working, doing the job that I love to do. I mean, my dad, God rest his soul, I only lost my dad a couple of years ago, and I miss him terrible. I mean, we're great pals. He A&R'd Boys Life's album. He A&R'd the whole album. And he was brutally honest. I'd be sending him demos of songs that we'd done, and he goes, "That's a turkey. That's shit. What are you thinking?" And I'd send him the finished, and he'd say, "You know, change that, tweak that." And I'd say to Brian, and Brian's going, "No, your dad's right." And before we mastered any song, we got my dad's approval, you know? So we dedicated the album to him, and we wrote him a little poem and stuff like that on the album, which is really, really nice. But my dad always said, if you enjoy what you do, you never work a day of your life. And it's very, very true. Very, very true.
Tell me, I guess, a similar vein of question. You know, when you've been, you know, doing a good few years of the band like in Boyzone, and you talk about taking a hiatus, as in at that point, like, you know, genuinely going to take a year off and come back, or you know, people like to break off and do solo stuff. I mean, you know, I may be completely wrong, but you know, when you look at so many other people do it, it never works out well for them. You know, like a big time TV actor in the UK, you know, wants to go and break Hollywood. So they go, they never break Hollywood, then they never get back on the TV back in England again either. Or, you know, someone who's been good as a 4 or 5 piece band, they you know, they want to be the solo star. They go off and try solo stuff. Never works. When you take that break, or when you go and try something, do you have that fear of failing and then the inability to go back to what was working out for you anyway, or are you just, let's say, single-minded on your goals, on your journey, on your career progression, and if that means that, you know, it doesn't work out and some doors have been closed and you don't care?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I mean, I'd be guilty of that myself. When I was in Coronation Street, I didn't have huge amount of acting experience before then, a lot of amateur stuff when I was a kid, but I always loved being on stage. You learn the craft quite quick in a soap. They shoot at a very, very fast speed. They could shoot up to 10 episodes a week, you know, and you're only given the scripts maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the shoot, but you can't learn them that head because you're already in a shoot. So you learn your lines the night before you shoot them, really. I mean, you read your storyline, you read your scripts, but you learn the lines off book the night before because you're shooting every day and they don't shoot in sequence, right? So they don't shoot one episode after the other. They'll do blocks of five. So you might do a scene from episode 5, a scene from episode 3, a scene from episode 2, and you could be working with 2 different directors on different blocks. So it's a real, you know, you learn the job very, very quick on the job in a soap. I think it's the toughest acting gig there is. But when my first contract was coming up, I wanted to do more work. I loved being behind the camera and I loved the job. So like anybody, I kind of had ideas of grandeur, and I went over to LA for pilot season.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah, I went over. Pilot season is usually from the end of February into March, right through May, June, April, May. And it's when they cast all the shows that are coming out. on Netflix, on Apple TV, on Amazon, the movies, all the indie movies. It's when they cast for everything. So everybody from all over the world that wants to be an actor is in LA at that time. And it's a rat race. You know, if you're going for a specific role with one of the bigger studios, you go into a room, a waiting room, and there's 20 people sitting around the room all going for your part. These people are trying to take your money off you. They're trying to stop you paying your mortgage. You know what I mean? And you're in that room and there's nobody talking because you're all against each other. And it's a rat race. It's really tough. I mean, 1 or 2% of actors make it to the top level, you know, and that's what everybody's dreaming of. So I went over anyway, and I got very close to some really big stuff. I was down to the last two for a show called Boardwalk Empire years ago. And I was actually told I had the gig, and they always give the gig to two people. And at the last minute, they decide which one is getting. So I was contracted and everything for where I was going to be put up in New York and Chelsea, where I was going to be living. And it's life changing. It's life changing. You know, the minimum payout, I think, on an American show, or it was at the time, is $25,000 per episode. But then you get a repeat fee of like 37% or something like that. But, and if there's eight episodes and it's $25,000, you know, $250,000, and you're doing what you love to do.
How quick do they record compared to like a UK soap?
No, UK soap is completely different. Right. This stuff, you prepare well, you prepare properly, you have time to digest the script, to understand it, to work with the director, to get your creative mind working, you know. But like I said, like the question you asked, people that leave a band to go solo, actors leaving a soap to want to be a movie star. I mean, it happens all the time. Some people do make it true. Mm-hmm. Most people don't. You know, it's a tough one. It's a real tough one. I had to come home with my tail between my legs. You know, I thought I had. We were celebrating everything that role. You know, but once you get one, it's like a chain reaction. You'll just get one after the other if you're good. You'll just get one after the other. It's getting that lucky break, and your fee goes up every time on every job you get, and it can never go less. So let's say you do two or three jobs and you've gone from 25 grand an episode up to 150 grand an episode. The next job to hire you, the next studio to hire you, has to give you your minimum of what you last got paid. So you're going straight in on 150 grand an ep. Like it's really, look, you're doing it because you love the job that you do. I mean, my preference is theater. There's no money in theater, but I love it. I love it. You know, so getting the movies and getting the payday affords you the ability to go back and do the theater. But look, everybody, if you don't push yourself and if you don't have ideas of grandeur and if you don't take a chance, you'll never know. You know what I mean? And that's the thing. And if you don't make it, well, at least you gave it a chance. It's difficult. It's tough. You know, Ronan left Boyzone for a solo career, and he's had a relatively very successful career. I do think Ronan is a very hard worker. He's a grafter. He works hard. My God, the hours that guy works. He's driven. But I'm sure he would have loved his solo career to go further than it did, but that's because he's hungry. You know what I mean? Who wouldn't? You know, you get the likes of the success that Robbie Williams had after coming out of Take That, and that's a different.
That's unique.
That's unique. I mean, he played. What's the venue he played two nights? 180,000 people a night. The massive place that Robbie played.
Back in the UK.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of it now.
Networth,
yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Robbie played Networth. That's massive, mate. He done a stadium tour. I mean, one man coming out of a boy band from fucking Stockport, you know, or is he from Stockport?
Stoke-on-Trent.
So, like, that's a huge success story. He was bigger than Take That everywhere. Now, Take That went on to do a stadium tour themselves later on, but the Gary Barlow, he didn't go on. I mean, Gary Barlow is a great singer, a great songwriter, but he didn't make it as a solo star. You know what I mean? Not to the level that Robbie did. You know what I mean? So there's loads of examples of people that they have a successful career, but it's not to the level that they would have likened it to be, you know? And to be brutally honest about it, Boys Life and what Brian and I do, yeah, I'll be very honest. We do enjoy the gigs that we do, but I'd love the opportunity or the option to go and play an arena tour, you know, because look, we're not getting any younger. We have to provide for our future. We have to provide for our pension. As you know yourself, my knees are fucked. You know, I need to get two new knees. That's going to be off the road for at least 3 months, you know, and I've got bills to pay like everybody else. So doing the arenas is cream. Okay. So if you're doing two or three nights in the same arena, That's a lot of money because you've got all the bills for the load in and the load out. But if you've got two or three nights in the middle, there's no load in and no load out. Nope. So you're making pure profit. If you're only doing one night in a venue, you know, you're limited to the money that you can make because you've got the load in and the load out on the same day. But if you get two nights or even three nights, the difference financially is not just doubled, it's tripled, it's quadrupled. It's
when did you first start to see the money in Boyzone? You know, how
man, everybody thought we were millionaires and we hadn't a pot to piss in.
Really?
Everybody thought we were so famous and everybody thought we were millionaires and we hadn't had a penny. Most bands get an advance payment. Like Westlife got an advance payment. We never got an advance payment. Our record company never paid us in advance. And I was telling you before, the record company said, get your clothes cleaned and we'll pick up the bill. You know, they're flying us around private jets and chauffeur driven cars. We're looking at all this going, wow, this is amazing. Until we get, when we do start to make money and the money does start to roll in, it's nowhere near what you think it's going to be. So your accountants will audit the record company and find out what money is due to you, what's coming, what expenses have you got. And then you're looking at all these chauffeur-driven cars and private jets all being recouped out of your money, right? But it's not recouped at the price that the record company paid for it. They put their own levy on top for paying for it. So if you're going to rent a private jet for 25 grand to bring it to Paris, right? By the time you pay that back, you're probably paying back 32 grand because you're paying back the 25 grand plus a 15% levy for the record company. So they recoup anything that you spend. You go into the hotel bar, you're signing all the drinks to your room, you're buying people over their drinks and you're living like a king. And then 2 or 3 years later, you realize that bar bill was 1,800 quid and it's coming out of your money with a 15% levy on top. You know, so you're not educated like this. Nobody explains this to you. Nobody breaks it down and helps you understand how the music business works. Now, it's not like that anymore. Since downloading and streaming and all these different platforms, illegal or not legal, the 90% of the revenue of the music business is gone. Because nobody's buying albums or CDs anymore. So the money's gone. The money in our business now is selling tickets. Going back to your point, would you like to do the arenas? Financially, it makes a huge difference. Yes. Creatively, the theatres that we play in are fantastic. We enjoy the night. But if a theatre holds 2,500 people or 3,000 people and an arena holds 30,000 people, we have to work 10 times as hard to make the same money that we'd have to do in one night. Do you know what I mean?
So back in the Boyzone days, obviously you were signing bills and the record company taking care of things, but were you given like an actual wage to live on as well?
No. We in the early days, we used to get about 30 quid a week each, which was crazy. We got paid, our first paycheck was 10 grand each. And I remember when that paycheck came through, I thought I was the richest man in Ireland.
And how long have you been in the band then?
Sorry?
How long have you been in?
2.5 years.
That was the first time you got that kind of money?
Yeah, the pipeline payments in the music business take a long time to come through. And now obviously you're touring and the touring is your own money. That's nothing to do with the record company. Now the bands of today, the likes of One Direction when they were out, they signed what's called a 360 deal, right? 360 obviously being a full circle. So that means the record company are not doing what the record company used to, which is just do the records. Then you've got your agent and your promoter to do the concerts. Then you've got your merchandising company that do the merchandising, and it's all separate entities. The record company changed all that and they created what's called 360 contracts for all the guys coming through, like the X Factor that might get a record deal. And the guys coming through that wanted a record deal, they just want to sing. They want to do what they love to do. Some of them want to be really famous. Some of them just love the craft and they want to sing. But they had no choice but to sign a 360 deal. So the 360 deal incorporated your merchandising, your ticket sales, every single thing you do.
Is it better for you as an artist?
No. Oh, okay. No, because the record company are getting a piece of everything then. You know what I mean? Like, that should be all yours.
I guess it maybe cuts both ways. Yeah, they get a piece of everything, but they've also got the like great reach to be able to get you into places.
Fine, but the comparison I'm making is the record deals of old compared to the record deals of now, there's no money in the ones of now. You're getting so, okay, so 20% of something is better than 100% of nothing. That's fair enough. Our record deal, which still stands in play, is one of the old ones. Sure. So we'd still make money on the albums, but not a lot because they say nobody's buying CDs and tapes anymore.
But you still, to this day, get paid for the 30-year-old Boyzone.
Yeah, we would have residuals coming through, royalties all the time. But you get that in everything. I mean, I did one show on BBC, I think it was called Death in Paradise. And it's a murder mystery show that's shot over in Guadeloupe, a French colony in the Caribbean. And I shot one episode. I played the bass in a band, and I was the murderer. I killed the lead singer, and it's a who did it type thing. And it's I signed the deal, but the residuals that come in off that every year, just one episode. I wish I had done two or three of those episodes, because it's unbelievable. But then you look at Coronation Street, and I did Coronation Street on and off for 10 years, and I still get paid from Coronation Street. I still get residuals from Coronation Street. It's not like Death in Paradise. It's not as big as that. I don't know why the difference is so big, but I still get residuals from it. But we used to get 37% repeat fee of our episode fee. So if I was getting £1,000 an episode, I'd be getting 370 quid every time it was shown on an omnibus or on another program. And I'm actually in the process at the moment of finding out, am I entitled to that now? Because people are stopping me on the street, because there's a whole rerun of all the Coronation Street episodes on one of the channels at the moment. And it's obviously, I've got storyline at the moment. So people for the first time in ages are stopping me again going, oh, you're on Coronation Street. You know, that was 20 years ago. I was in another show called Love Hate. I played a bodybuilding coke dealer in this Irish drama. Very, very good. Very well written. Very, very good show. I'm in series 4 or 5. And that was great. And then there was another show, kind of a comedy show called The Job Lot. And I did one episode of that. And I'm fixing the phones in a call center, the job center, basically. Yeah. And it's very funny. Somebody just sent me the clip the other day. And I'm in that, but they're all on Netflix. And I haven't acted in years. And I'm on 3 different shows on Netflix. So I'm trying to find out who owes me what.
You've mentioned your kids a couple of times while we've been having this chat, and obviously you've got Jay and Mia. How old are they both now?
Jay recently turned 28. He was born in 96. And me and my daughter, she's 24. She was born in 2000. So I was actually in the Big Brother house on Mia's first birthday. I did the very, very first Celebrity Big Brother. And that was back in 2001. And Mia was one on the 11th of March, and I was locked in the house that day, and I got all the housemates, and we did it for comic relief, we weren't being paid. Louis Walsh recently did Celebrity Big Brother, and he's been noticed to be bragging about getting paid $600,000 or £600,000 for doing it. We did it for free. And it's ironic that he's doing it, because I just left Boys On at the time. We literally left at the end of 99 into 2000. And I the first thing I did was Celebrity Big Brother, which was great for me, because that's really what kind of got Kieran Roberts, the executive producer of Coronation Street, aware of who I was and what I was, because he wanted an Irish character in the soap, and he has Irish heritage himself. And my name ended up being Kieran as well. But Mia's 24. Mia was one, and I got all the cast members to sing her happy birthday, but they didn't show it. They never put it out on air, because they didn't want any favourability going on with the voting. They didn't want to give me an unfair advantage by being so nice and caring. Jesus, my daughter's first birthday. They should have let me say. My wife had a fight with me when I got out of the house because I didn't say happy birthday to my daughter. And I go, I wasn't in control of the editing, baby, you know. But yeah, me and my daughter Mia, when she was about 18 months old, we kind of thought she wasn't responding the way Jay had, her older brother had, 4 years previous. And we were a little bit concerned. We didn't know what was quite the problem. She would do this kind of tensing thing with her arms, and she'd get very overexcited, overstimulated by the television and stuff like that. And she was nonverbal. She wasn't really talking. So I had no idea the problem, what was going on, but we didn't talk about it enough at all, because we were afraid of what we might figure out. You know what I mean? It was a very, very scary time for a young family with a daughter, and you're thinking there might be a significant problem here, you know?
And is that how autism works, in that you don't find out pre-birth, as in, you know, like when you have all your baby tests and stuff?
Yeah, no.
This doesn't show up?
No. And diagnosis is imperative, okay? Early intervention is essential for the future of the child. So a diagnosis is essential as early as you can, because you can't access any of the services that you need if you don't have an official diagnosis. But then in Ireland at the time, there was a 3.5 year waiting list through the state to have a diagnosis done. They're telling you early intervention is essential, but yet there's a 3.5 year waiting list for a diagnosis. So how can you help your child? So these are all the issues. But I didn't know what autism was. I'd never heard of autism. I mean, I'd heard of the Rain Man and that type of thing, but that's not really a good understanding of what autism actually is. Autism is ASD, autism spectrum disorder. And in any spectrum disorder, it means it can be very, very mild and very, very extreme. It goes infinitely on both sides. I had, obviously, I was back in Ireland. I was trying to find out who I was. I was trying to figure out, I left Boys on at 26. You know, my career effectively was over at 26, and I needed to figure out what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And I didn't know what I was going to be singing or acting or, presenting TV or radio. I didn't know. I knew I wanted to stay in the entertainment business, but I didn't know where I was, where I belonged. So it was a tough time. But I had a familiar face. So people would often ask me to do charity work to promote the charity, because if you have somebody with a familiar face, they, you might get a bit of press or media off the back of it. So a friend of mine rang me up and he said, a friend of his was running a charity golfing event, and I didn't play golf at the time. And he said, he just wants to know, will you turn up to the golf club and get a photograph taken on the first tee? It would really, really support this charity. And I said, yeah, no problem. So I turned up, I met the guy who ran the charity, and we swung the club on the first tee, and all the press paparazzi were there. I hadn't been home in Dublin for years because, I mean, I would be, but I wouldn't be out and out. I wouldn't be seen there because I'd only be home to see the family and I'd be gone again. So to get the opportunity to photograph me at the time, was all the journalists and all the photographers came out. So I was promoting his charity. I says, what's the charity? He says, oh, it's a school that we've put together and opened ourselves for the education and the intervention of children with autism. I said, what's autism? And he goes, well, my little girl has autism, and basically it's a neurological developmental disorder that can affect, learning difficulties. There's a whole array of different disabilities that seem to be related together through the word autism. And I kept asking him questions because every answer he gave me, I could relate it to my daughter. So I was getting really kind of emotional now, because I'm quite certain now that I've figured out what the problem is with my daughter. She has autism. And he could see I was getting a little bit emotional. So he knew I was asking the questions for a reason. So he said, look, maybe my wife would be better to speak to than I am. So his wife came and sat down beside me and we spoke. And I ultimately was fighting the tears because I knew now, I was certain now my daughter had autism, and I was scared out of my mind. I didn't know what the fuck to do. I knew this was going to break my wife's heart because she wouldn't know what to do either. So I remember going home, I rang my older brother actually, and I was crying on the phone. I left the golf course and I get into my Jeep, and I had blackout windows in the Jeep. So I once again, because the lady came out with her four kids to wave goodbye to me from the golf course. And of course I just wanted to cry. So I started crying, but like I say, I had black windows. And I rang my older brother and I just said, I was very emotional on the phone to my brother. He goes, look, where are you? I was pissing down with rain. I was on the M50, which is the ring road outside of Dublin. And it was dangerous because the rain was pumping down and tears coming out of my eyes. I was very upset. And he said, look, just pull over. I'll be there in 20 minutes. So I pulled into the hard shoulder and my brother turned up and he said, look, just drive your car behind mine. I'll get you home. So he kind of drove in front of me and we got home and he goes, look, I'm not coming in. This is going to be a moment for you and your missus. So he said, I'll stay in the car outside. And if I don't hear from you in 15 or 20 minutes, I'll go on home. I said, right, grand. So I walked into the house and I had red eyes. My wife could see I'd been crying. She said, geez, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? And I just said, look, I think Mia has autism. And she gave me a smack across the face out of complete shock. And then she hugged me and we both cried. And that was the start of my journey. I realized then that early intervention was essential, but I couldn't access it without a diagnosis. The diagnosis is a 3.5 year waiting list. So I'm going to have to find something to do privately. And even getting it done privately then, there's no services available in Ireland. And I found loads of other parents that were going through the same shit, that nobody wanted to look after their kids. Nobody wanted to maintain the appropriate intervention and the tailored education that you need for a child with autism. So we just decided to do it ourselves as parents. We got the committee together. We started up Irish Autism Action, and I just threw myself right in to learning and educating myself on what needed to be done, and that's how I dealt with it. Because as Mia got older, she never spoke till she was 7. So
not a word.
No, just not like non-verbal, completely non-verbal. The first time we heard her voice, she came into the kitchen. I'll never forget it. I had a hangover again, lying on the sofa watching telly, and if she had to walk through this room to get to the kitchen there, she just walked by us. And she watched Annie, the musical Annie, over and over again. She had the same movies that she'd look, and she'd watch it, the TV right here. And the song Tomorrow from Annie? Tomorrow, yeah. Tomorrow. She walked through singing that song, but she'd never spoken before. So it was like she was a deaf person trying to sing. Oh, like that. But it was a sound, it was a noise. We knew what she could sing. We knew the song she was trying to sing. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. We were all bawling. It was an amazing breakthrough. We had a system at home called PECS. Because you remember, there was no smartphones, there was no iPads, there was no tablets. So we had Velcroed pieces of Velcroed photographs to a chart of her bottle, her blankie, her favorite crisps, her favorite sweets. So when she wanted something, it's called the PECS system, picture exchange communication. Oh. So she'd come in and she'd point and I'd go, show me on the chart, show me on the chart. And she'd pull off the Velcro of her milk. I say, good girl, say milk. And this is what you have to do. And even if she just makes a stammer or she mutters something, you go, good girl, very good. And you reward her. It's rewarding all the time. And then you go to the fridge, get the milk, but you don't let her take the milk. You go, say thank you. She says, makes an effort to say thank you. And you go, you're welcome. And off she goes. Put the card back on the chart, blah, blah, blah. But you've got to know when to take the chart away because they know. They know their disability. They understand it themselves. And they'll use it to their own advantage, right? So if you don't take the cards away in time, they'll get lazy with the speech. So you have to know. So the day we knew to take the chart away, she comes out and she goes, Papa. I said, good girl. I get the Papa, hand her the Papa, say thank you. She grabbed it out of my hand and went, you're welcome. And she ran off. So, you know, we opened a purpose school that had tailored education for the specific need of each individual child. There was part of that tailored education for Mia was a thing called ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis. It's a form of education. I think it was developed and put together in Massachusetts, in the New England Center of Massachusetts, which is a great center for children with autism, for the education of children and young adults with autism. So we went and visited the New England Center in Massachusetts, and We developed part of the ABA program in the school as part of the education, not solely. A lot of parents of children with autism don't believe in ABA. They think it's like training an animal. I completely disagree. I can only disagree because I've seen the help that it has given me in educating my daughter. And Mia now, you know, to let you know where Mia is now, Mia is 24 now. She graduated from university 2 years ago with A's, all honors. She's working for an American pharmaceutical company, coding on 3 platforms and software developing. She's got a male companion who's her friend. She passed her driving test first time. She's unbelievable. She sets the bar so high for herself and she really needs to achieve. She always wants to be peer equal or better. And she talks in the middle of an American accent, but she's the most beautiful girl in the world. And she's my absolute heart. I love her to death. And her brother is so good with her. You know, he's 4 years older than her and he's always been her best friend and that takes care of her. And his girlfriend is very good to her too. So I'm very, very lucky. But like with the right diagnosis at the right time, with the right intervention, It's the sky is the limit, but you've got to put the effort in. You've got to put the time and the effort in. The parents have to put the time and the effort in, not expect somebody else to do it for them. They have to do it for themselves. And if the more time they invest in the child, the bigger their investment will pay out later on in life for the quality of life that the child might have. You know, Mia is very content and happy. She's with me or she's with her mother most of the time, but she's very independent and she's very happy within herself and she's achieving her goals, which is the main thing. There's a show on Netflix at the moment called Love on the Spectrum. And it's every single kid is completely different, but there's so many similarities to having a child with autism in the house. And it's amazing to see these families all over America living so similarly to how we live with our daughter. And you just realize you're not on your own. And there's a million families experiencing the same things. You know, high performing autism children or young adults, they want to be loved. They want to be in a relationship. You know, they want all the things that we want for ourselves, you know, and I experienced that with my daughter, Mia. But looking at Love on the Spectrum, I can see there's so many little boys and girls like Mia out there that all want the same thing. And they suffer with the same anxieties. They suffer from the same stresses and upsets. And really, it's just if the rest of the world was to educate themselves a little bit more on autism and you know, understand they're trying to live in our environment, whereas we should try and live in theirs for a while. And it would make the world a much, much better place.
Well, listen, buddy, it's been an absolute pleasure talking. I mean, like I said at the beginning, we could make three episodes. We could probably make 33 episodes out of this. So I hope we get to do a round two again sometime soon. Certainly go deeper on the autism story, because I know you've got plenty to talk about and how you've been raising money and all the different philanthropic events you've done over the years. So thanks a lot for being here, mate. And
no, thanks for having me, Matt. It's been great.
Absolute pleasure.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Stripping Off with Matt Haycox. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this week's episode, but please remember to subscribe or to follow, and please, please leave a review. If you can leave a review, that's how we move up the algorithm, that's how we get to the top of the charts, and that's how I can keep bringing you bigger and better guests that you'll love each week. Have you got any suggestions for guests? Have you got any burning questions you want to ask? Well, slide into my DMs on social at Stripping Off with Matt Haycox.